Roughly Speaking with Dan Rogics is brought to you by the Ivy Bookshop, an independent bookstore at Falls Road and Lake Avenue in Baltimore. The Ivy Bookshop, your book is waiting.
Hello from the Baltimore Sun, I'm Dan Rogics, and this is Roughly Speaking, episode 384.
We're not ready for the next epidemic. If anything kills over 10 million people in the next few decades, it's most likely to be a highly infectious virus.
That's Bill Gates, Microsoft founder, billionaire, and philanthropist, sounding one of his many warnings about how the U.S. and the world is not prepared for the possibility of a global pandemic. Recently, Gates highlighted an estimate that some 33 million people could die if a disease like the deadly Spanish flu of a century ago were to become airborne. Dr. John Smarr, an infectious disease specialist on the staff of Sinai Hospital in Baltimore, will join us today to talk about Gates' warnings. And social political commentator Michael Rice joins us again to try to explain Donald Trump, or how, with all the chaos in the administration, he manages to maintain a base of support among people who will likely be hurt, or at the very least not helped very much, by his policies on taxes, the social safety net, and trade.
Trump is appealing to things of a visceral nature that have nothing to do with people's pocketbooks. The argument had always been, you know, people vote their pocketbooks. I think now non-economic things are overriding economic concerns. And I think that Trump is appealing to that by scapegoating populations that are easy targets for scapegoats.
Michael Reich and Dr. Smarr join us later on in this big weekend episode of Roughly Speaking. We'll also be hearing from Kevin Kamenetz, the Baltimore County executive who is running for the Democratic nomination for governor of Maryland. His running mate, former Montgomery County Councilwoman Valerie Irvin, will also be with us. That's coming up right after we get our weekly book recommendation from Paula Gallagher. This week's treat is from the new nonfiction shelf, The Feather Thief, by Kirk Wallace Johnson. The story of a young man's obsession and a heist that took place in 2009 from the British Natural History Museum in Tring, northwest of London. But the story begins here in the States, at the home of Edwin Rist, a music prodigy living with his parents in New York.
We go to the Hudson Valley to a young teenager who is homeschooled, he and his brother, by Ivy League parents. He is very focused, in particular, on learning to play the flute. He knows he's going to be a professional flautist. But his side hobby is tying Victorian salmon flies. His brother had found an old video cassette, was studying the physics of trout fishing with flies. And the boys start to try to tie on their own. They apprentice themselves and get taught by a master fly fisherman, fly tyer, and they become very obsessed. The guides to tying these salmon flies were written in the Victorian era, and salmon flies are very intricate works of art. They're not being tied to fish with. They're tied for the sake of the art and tying them. They're very difficult, painstaking work. And the recipes, I'll call it, to make one of these flies call for all sorts of esoteric materials, many birds, feathers that are very rare from every corner of the planet, and they're very expensive. They're hard to get a hold of because the birds are protected now. Some birds have gone extinct. So he gets accepted, flash forward, to the Royal Academy of Music in London as a flautist. And while he's there, he's continuing to tie flies. He's gotten lots of actual national recognition. People have written about him. And he realizes that he's near Tring, which has these amazing storehouses of these birds. And if he had a few of the feathers, he could really elevate his art. But then he thinks further, if he sold these feathers, he could buy a new flute. He could really upscale his life. And this is the time, 2008 into 9, the recession is happening. His family has lost money. And so this is his plan, and he breaks into the museum and steals 299 bird skins. I'm going to stop there in telling you about what happens as things go on. The book is just fascinating. It's a book that I read in the span of 2 days. It is a little bit history, a little bit mystery, natural history. The author himself stumbles onto this story, becomes obsessed, does his own sleuthing, becomes a character almost in his own story. It's very well written, highly entertaining. It's journalism at its best, that immersive kind of story, like I said, where the author gets involved. It's got great color illustrations. If you knew nothing about fly fishing or tying, it doesn't matter. As long as you like a well-written story, you'll learn about the Indian crow and the flame chatterer and the flame bowerbird. Again, I highly recommend spending time with The Feather Thief by Kirk Wallace Johnson.
Paula Gallagher is a librarian in the Baltimore County Public Library System. You can find her at the Pikesville branch and hear her book recommendations each week on Roughly Speaking, one of two podcasts produced here at the Baltimore Sun.
Hi, I'm Quinn Kelly, and I host a weekly podcast for the Baltimore Sun called Female Trouble. Each Tuesday, we feature a new long-form conversation with one of the area's most interesting and accomplished women, from public officials and congresswomen to rappers and restaurant owners. You can find Female Trouble on iTunes, SoundCloud, Stitcher, or wherever you listen to podcasts. Find more info at baltimoresun.com/femaletrouble.
Kevin Kamenetz, the Baltimore County executive who is running for governor, visited us on Wednesday right after making an announcement related to the opioid epidemic. The county will spend $3 million to renovate a building at the old Rosewood Center in Owings Mills for an on-demand 70-bed treatment center for people addicted to heroin and other opioids. Baltimore City has been way ahead on this, led by the effort of its health commissioner. Anne Arundel County has added resources and funding and even brought litigation in response to the opioid problem there. Baltimore County stepped up its game this week. Kevin Kamenetz was here with his gubernatorial running mate, former Montgomery County Councilwoman Valerie Irvin, and we recorded a conversation about their campaign for the Democratic nomination. We'll bring you that conversation next week. For now, here's Kevin Kamenetz and Valerie Irvin on the opioid addiction crisis and what Baltimore County is finally doing about it.
We announced our efforts, our continuing efforts to fight the real dilemma of opioid addiction. Number one, we are treating addiction not as a stigma, but an illness, and it's an education factor involved in that. Number two, we're using naloxone, making sure it's available to all of our first responders and even in schools, but also for families as a life-saving opportunity. But that's just, of course, a temporary measure. We want to pursue lawsuits, a legal action, and we just filed last week a federal lawsuit against drug manufacturers and distributors who willingly engaged in a campaign of deception to physicians, convincing them that prescribing opioids for chronic pain as opposed to acute pain was acceptable, and downplaying this real risk of addiction. And that the distributors clearly understood that there were more pills being distributed to communities than there were residents in those communities. And number four is better police interdiction. We need to make sure that our law enforcement folks are working aggressively to stop the importation of heroin and fentanyl. But the fifth point here has nothing to do with legal or criminal pursuit. It has to do with really trying to cure the addiction. And that's to make sure that there are sufficient treatment-on-demand beds. The state hasn't taken enough action to ensure that there are beds. And when you think of an addict who has reached rock bottom, that's when you got to grab them, when they say, okay, I'm ready. And you have to be able to put that person into an evidence-based treatment-on-demand bed to receive help to break that cycle of addiction. So we couldn't get any movement from the state, so now we are funding this out of county funds. We're spending $3 million to upgrade a facility on the Rosewood campus in Owings Mills that will have 70 beds and will serve 300 people a year, providing additional treatment-on-demand opportunities.
And I ask why now. What is the scope of the opioid epidemic in Baltimore County?
Well, like the rest of the state and the rest of this country, it's horrific. The numbers are growing substantially every year. Last year, we lost over 300 people in the first 6 months.
From overdoses?
Yes. So it's a real challenge everywhere. But the key is we've been talking about this for a while statewide. We haven't taken the concrete steps that are necessary to start moving the needle in the right direction, and that really has been treatment on demand. So we had a facility in mind. It had previously been our DWI facility that had been operated by Right Turn of Maryland decades ago. So it was already in an area that people were accustomed to some type of substance abuse basis there. The site became available again, and I said, look, we're gonna move forward and get this done. So what we're also going to do is try and develop a public-private partnership where we're going to have a qualified provider make bids on the site and start operation hopefully in the next 18 months.
It took a crisis to get us here. I mean, the things you outline is all progressive, and I applaud what you're doing, but it seems like something that could have been in place 20 years ago. You were a prosecutor once upon a time. You put people in jail for dealing drugs in Baltimore City, right, years ago when you were a prosecutor.
When I was a prosecutor back last century, crack was the big
in
epidemic.
The 90s, right?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. I guess I'm just maybe being rhetorical here, but I mean, it's glad to see the county do this. It just seems like this is something that should have been in place a long time ago. You've had drug addicts in Baltimore County for decades, not just in Baltimore City. People who drive in from Baltimore County, Carroll County, to buy drugs in Baltimore City.
You know what I think has raised the awareness, particularly with this fentanyl crisis, is that it impacts everyone, male, female, young, old, urban, suburban,
more
rural,
suburban. We have to concede.
College, no,
that
college
the
educated.
Awareness of this, the awareness of this and the urgency about it has become more acute since it reached the suburbs and rural areas.
No doubt. I mean, absolutely.
That's just the reality here, isn't it?
Absolutely.
Yeah. I'm glad you're doing what you're doing. It just seems late to me. And it, not just on your watch as county executive, but earlier county executives. There's a long history of resistance to treatment centers in Baltimore County.
Well, all I can tell you is I don't think it's late. I think I'm the only one really stepping up to the plate because I don't think the other jurisdictions are doing the things that we're doing. And, you know, it's a cost factor. You know, I've got to make budgetary priorities, and this is an important priority for me.
Sorry, what did you want
to
add
to
that?
This is a really important topic to me. Kevin and I may not believe the same things 100% of the time, and this is one of the things I wanted to add to what he already said about the opioid crisis. As somebody who organized workers in the South and in the Heartland for a long time, one of the things that became very evident to all of us who were door knocking and talking to working people was that there is a sense of despair in our country where people work at jobs that have no future. They're dead end jobs. People are feeling bad about where they are in the sort of like the pecking order of this society. And what really brought the opioid crisis to everyone's attention was Donald Trump, when he found out about it for the first time when he was running for president, when he was in New Hampshire and in Iowa and in Indiana and in America's heartland and all over the place, this epidemic has been killing people for decades. And I applaud what the county executive is doing, but one of the things he did say was this happened to the black community during the crack cocaine epidemic. And so I for one, like to always focus on what is the root cause of this kind of drug abuse and drug use in this country? Why is it happening? What are people running from? What are they trying to block out? How do they get through the day? And so I think these are opportunities for us to ask those questions as policymakers and leaders in our communities, that what the county executive is doing is absolutely 100% needed. But I also have to look people in the eye who are in a family that's suffering with a person who is addicted and what we can do. And a lot of times, those are people who have been chronically unemployed. There's a chronic unemployment problem in the state of Maryland and in the country, and those people have just given up. And so there's so much more to be said about the opioid crisis and the epidemic that we're facing in this country, but it's going to require people like Kevin and me. I'm coming from a perspective that's a little different from his, but it's going to get us to the same place. So I just wanted to add that.
We'll have more conversation with Kevin Kamenetz and his running mate, Valerie Ervin, next week on the show. The Maryland primary is June 26th, so be listening for more interviews with the Democratic candidates for governor in the coming weeks.
Roughly Speaking with Dan Rodericks is brought to you by the Ivy Bookshop, an independent bookstore at Falls Road and Lake Avenue in Baltimore. This month, the Ivy welcomes Michael Downs to celebrate the launch of his book, The Strange and True Tale of Horace Wells, Surgeon Dentist. Downs imagines the mysteries behind the true story of Horace Wells, who first used laughing gas as an anesthetic, reshaping medicine and humanity's relationship with pain. Thursday, May 10th at 7 p.m. at the Ivy Bookshop, 6080 Falls Road. For more information, call 410-377-2966 or go to www.theivybookshop.com. The Ivy Bookshop, your book is waiting.
Well, Republicans in the House of Representatives, in their roles as Trump lackeys, have nominated their man for the Nobel Peace Prize. They're also attacking the Justice Department and Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein, it's pronounced Stein, for the Mueller investigation of Russian influence in the 2016 Trump campaign and possible obstruction of justice by the president. And then we find out from Rudy Giuliani that the president lied about the hush money for the porn queen known as Stormy Daniels. Meanwhile, the Trump base of support holds, and that includes people who could be hurt by, certainly not helped much by, Trump's economic policies, whether you're talking about the tax cuts, mostly for corporations and the wealthy, or trade policy, tariffs that will likely raise the cost of goods, or new harsh rules on food stamps and other benefits from the social safety net. I had a conversation about this the other day with Michael Reich, a scholar on social policy and a professor of social justice at the University of Maryland School of Social Work. I saw a tweet the other day, I think from somebody on the political left, who said, if Trump supporters only realized that we care more about them than he does, we'd be in a different world right now, or something to that effect. The point being, we, meaning, I guess it means the left, the Democratic Party, the sentiment was that, you know, those of us who support good government, who support the social safety net, who want government to do good things and not have the government torn down, are there for people who need help when they need it, whether it's unemployment compensation or food stamps or, you know, support for college education for their kid, whatever it is. And that's one of the head scratchers. Why people vote against their best interest by voting for Donald Trump? What is this about? If it's about economic anxiety in the heartland, how is Trump helping those people?
Well, clearly he's not, from an objective standpoint, helping those people at all. I mean, the things that generated their anxiety are partly economic, but they don't know where to channel that anxiety. If you said it's a result of globalization, the financialization of the American economy, the commodification of, to use big words, of basic things like healthcare, housing, education, the privatization of everything. Where do they direct that anger? It's hard. And there is no entity, neither the Democratic Party, nor unions, nor any other, nor an organized social movement, to direct that anger, anxiety in a constructive direction toward the people who were most responsible. People were angry after the 2008 recession because the banks basically got away with murder, mm-hmm. and no one got punished for it, and yet people lost their homes, lost their jobs, lost their retirement, and so forth. But the government didn't do anything about it. So it reinforced the narrative that the government is either useless or on the side of the corporations, but where is the entity that's on their side? So there's always, since Reagan at least, there's been this anti-government sentiment, and this the last 10 years has just fueled it. So here comes Trump and people like Trump and the media who support Trump, and basically they tapped into another source of people's anxiety, which I called several years ago demographic panic. People have calling it, you know, cultural status loss of, you know, white male privilege being challenged, et cetera, et cetera. So rather than address the objective issues which are affecting them, like employment and affordability of housing and healthcare and their children's college education, they're directed in terms that tapping into their prejudices, the notion that all of this government help is only helping the people who are other, who are different from
immigrants,
immigrants,
Muslims,
Muslims, people of color, the lesbian,
LGBT,
gay, right. Mm-hmm. I remember, and this has been going on, Dan, for a long time. I remember being asked by the AFL-CIO sometime in the early 1980s. They took me out of preschool to do that. And there was a great deal of layoffs at the time as a result of the 81-82 recession that was affecting the steel industry, the auto industry, electronic, all the industrial things that, you know, East and Baltimore and Dundalk and things like that. And I was asked to go there to consult with a group in the union hall. There were 500 or 600 people there, mm-hmm. about how to get the supportive services that they would need while they were either waiting to get rehired or making the transition to another job. And many of these people, most of them men, but not all, and they were not all white, were there to working in those industries for anywhere from 10 to 40 years. The anger that was coming there was palpable, but it was diffuse. It wasn't directed at those damn corporations or the damn banks or whatever. It was, oh, you know, we can't get these benefits. They're all going to the, and I won't repeat the word.
Mm-hmm.
So it created a sort of a dilemma for me, like, how do I respond to this particular situation? But that's not the point that I'm trying to make. The point is that that kind of anger has been there for a long time, and I think that the changes in the population today, by 2040 approximately, there won't be a majority racially in this country, that, you know, gay lesbian culture has become more acceptable. The marriage equality has passed. Women, despite all of the ongoing inequalities, are occupying more positions of authority and power and so forth. And family roles are changing, and I could go on and on. I think for certain people, the combination of economic anxiety and cultural status anxiety, demographic anxiety, the loss of their dominance in society is a very powerful combination. And what Trump and his acolytes in the media have fed is the narrative that that's the problem, not the problem that is creating greater socioeconomic inequality and employment insecurity and so forth.
I'm with you, but I'll give you this. In December, they voted for these enormous tax cuts that generally were seen as going to the wealthy and to corporations, right? Well, that sentiment seems to have taken hold. If you go by polls, which is the only thing I can go by, is polls that indicate that the tax cuts aren't that popular, that people kind of see through them, don't expect to get much out of them, see them going mainly to the top and to big companies and to overseas investors. Some people have figured that out. At the same time, Trump's base holds at 39 or 40% and 78% of Republicans.
Right. Well, I think it gets back to this other issue that Trump is appealing to things of a visceral nature,
yeah,
that have nothing to do with people's pocketbooks. The argument had always been, you know, people vote their pocketbooks. You remember James Carville's thing, it's the economy, stupid.
Right.
I think now, for reasons that are complex and I don't fully have the answer to, non-economic things are overriding economic concerns, at least temporarily. And I think that Trump is appealing to that by scapegoating populations that are easy targets for scapegoats.
Maybe the people who support Trump aren't that bad off. Maybe if you look at the demographics of income levels of people who support Trump, maybe they're doing okay, and they like this visceral stuff.
I think it's divided. I think you get, this is a rough cut, but you get three groups of people. You get the wealthy, generally older white men and women, who are doing very well, who the tax cuts and everything else will benefit, and who are physically isolated and socially isolated from all the changes that are occurring in society. So these things don't really bother, but they are benefiting in their pocketbook. Then you get the evangelical vote, And, you know, I can't quote scripture, but the hypocrites just doesn't do it for them. It's not sufficient. Right. And they'll vote for someone who'll get a Neil Gorsuch on the Supreme Court or get anti-gay legislation passed.
Anti-abortion judges.
Regardless of the behavior of the person who's supporting him. I mean, they will forgive Trump anything. And then you get a third group of people because your argument goes so far, but how does it explain states like West Virginia?
Right.
Where, you know, Trump won by 40% to 50%. Mm-hmm. I mean, these are among the poorest white people in the country. Same thing is true for whites in Mississippi, Louisiana, Alabama, other parts. You can only explain it by racial animus and fear of the other that is so powerful that it overcomes their economic self-interest. But see a pushback on that now, possibly, with all of these teacher walkouts. In red states, Arizona,
that's very
Oklahoma.
Interesting. What do you see happening there?
Teachers who voted for Trump in very red areas. I mean, they finally just reached the end of their rope. I mean, they are. If you look at what they're paid and what the cost of living in those areas and the expectations that are put on them by various educational policies, I think they just decided enough.
Mm-hmm.
And whether that will translate into a national movement. Whether they will link up with other unions. I mean, because even many people who it was interesting polls, to quote polls, that the overwhelming majority of people support teachers should be paid more. We should spend more on education. An overwhelming majority of people supported the teachers' right to unionize, yet that was higher than people's overall support for unions in general. Mm-hmm. There's still the narrative out there that, you know, unions are just self-serving and greedy and so forth, which is why people like Scott Walker were able to get away with what he did in Wisconsin. And an anti-union line, unions as special interests, while bankers are not special interests, still somehow resonates in the American populace.
We'll have more on this topic with Michael Reich on next week's show. Michael Reich is the Daniel Thurs Distinguished Professor of Social Justice at the University of Maryland School of Social Work and a leading scholar on social work and social policy. He joins us from time to time to talk politics from his unique perspective, and he'll be back, as I say, next week.
We're not ready for the next epidemic. If anything kills over 10 million people in the next few decades, it's most likely to be a highly infectious virus.
Bill Gates continues to sound warnings about the possibility of a pandemic on the scale of the 1918 Spanish flu that killed millions worldwide, including some 675,000 Americans. Could such a thing happen again? Could such a thing happen again? Gates has issued his warning several times, whether in TED Talks or at global summits with his wife Melinda, or in press interviews. Last month, speaking to the Massachusetts Medical Society, Bill Gates said the U.S. has not sufficiently prepared for the, quote, significant probability of a large and lethal modern-day pandemic occurring in our lifetimes, end quote. He cited a recent estimate of 33 million deaths based on a simulation conducted by a disease modeling organization. That figure is eye-popping, so I asked Dr. John Smarr, an infectious disease expert and a regular on Roughly Speaking, for his perspectives on the possibility of a pandemic.
Even though this has been something that's been making the rounds currently, this is not the first time I've heard recently people talking about this. So back in March, the World Health Organization, which always has a list of diseases that they're concerned about to watch. So this includes everything from Ebola to Zika to things you sometimes hear about, but we've never had to deal with in the U.S., so most people don't know what they are, like Lassa fever, Crimean Congo hemorrhagic fever. There's all these terrifying hemorrhagic fever viruses that in a vague way are kind of similar to Ebola that have never, with their natural milieu, they've never actually caused a huge human outbreak that has happened yet. But this is like a list of things that the WHO watches. So they came out in March and they said they officially added disease X to the list. And so this is essentially philosophically not only the same thing that Bill Gates was talking about, but the same thing that I was talking about. If you remember back to our podcast from a few months ago, where I did my top, I think it was top five, top 10 diseases.
I remember, right. Mm-hmm.
And one of them was essentially unknown.
Yeah, that's right.
It was unknown.
It was one. I remember now. Yeah.
Because this is something that even Anthony Fauci from the NIH, so this is something that over the last 6 months to a year, ever since sort of Zika seems to be tailing off, we currently don't have an issue with Ebola, but it's this concept that for each of these diseases, it's clear that we haven't had the level of preparedness, perhaps, that we should. There is excitement with regards to people putting money into preparedness. And then once it fades away, there suddenly start being questions of, is it really worth it for us to keep putting money into this, to keep putting time and effort into this? And so this is not only at the federal level when you're talking about budget issues, especially with the current administration and their approach to the CDC or budgeting.
Science in general.
Science in general, that's for sure. But it even comes down to the local level. If you think over the last few years, what we dealt with Ebola.
If there's one positive thing that can come out of the Ebola epidemic, it's that it can serve as a early warning, a wake-up call to get ready.
Different hospitals throughout the state of Maryland, and you had sort of designations that were given to those. So you had Hopkins and University of Maryland, which clearly the idea was that if we had an Ebola case, that would be the ultimate destination. But even for those of us at Sinai, the other hospitals in Lifebridge, the other hospitals in the state, you had to have a degree of preparation because the whole point was if somebody showed up, you had to at least in the short term be able to take care of that person in a way that would give them hopefully the best effective supportive care and was the safest for all of us who worked there.
Let's look at Ebola. The problem wasn't that there was a system that didn't work well enough. The problem was that we didn't have a system at all. We didn't have a group of epidemiologists ready to go who would have gone, seen what the disease was, see how far it had spread. The case reports came in on paper. We didn't have a medical team ready to go. We didn't have a way of preparing people. And a large epidemic would require us to have hundreds of thousands of workers. There was no one there to look at treatment approaches, no one to look at the diagnostics, no one to figure out what tools should be used. Now, we could have taken the blood of survivors, processed it, and put that plasma back in people to protect them. But that was never tried. So there was a lot that was missing. And these things are really a global failure. The WHO is funded to monitor epidemics, but not to do these things I talked about.
So what does that leave us with a couple of years down the line? Everybody bought up lots of personal protective equipment as an easy example. So Sinai, as with all of these hospitals, we stockpiled a lot of different personal protective equipment as a just-in-case type of thing, imagining the worst-case scenario. But now it's sort of the question of, well, how do you maintain this? Is it worth to maintain it? How many people do you keep training on it?
I think we go through a period of public awareness when there's a problem, like the Ebola period.
Right, right.
But then how many people retain that or maintain vigilance in their own household, even?
The failure to prepare could allow the next epidemic to be dramatically more devastating than Ebola.
When I hear Bill Gates saying that we're not prepared, what is adequate preparation?
He's really talking about viral things, and there is an example given of influenza. But we had an awful influenza year this year, and we weren't even dealing with a pandemic strain like the 2009 H1N1, which had genetically changed, and that was one reason that it came through the population so quickly.
You can have a virus where people feel well enough while they're infectious that they get on a plane or they go to a market. The source of the virus could be a natural epidemic like Ebola, or it could be bioterrorism. And so there are things that would literally make things 1,000 times worse.
So adequate preparation is one, you have to have money that is set aside for multiple reasons, one of which is disease surveillance.
Now, I don't have an exact budget for what this would cost, but I'm quite sure it's very modest compared to the potential harm. The World Bank estimates that if we have a worldwide flu epidemic, global wealth will go down by over $3 trillion, and we'd have millions and millions of deaths. These investments offer significant benefits beyond just being ready for the epidemic. the primary health care, the R&D, those things would reduce global health equity and make the world more just as well as more safe. So I think this should absolutely be a priority. There's no need to panic. We don't have to hoard cans of spaghetti or go down into the basement. But we need to get going because time is not on our side.
So making sure that we have adequate resources for risk assessment is the biggest thing. We don't want to find out 12 months later when this Zika thing was starting in Brazil that suddenly it's a problem for the U.S. and oh, now there's a bunch of people exposed. We want to be able to have the technology and the resources and the people whose job it is to meaningfully pay attention to figure out that once something starts brewing in even some other area of the world, that there is a potential risk for the United States with regards to globalization.
Are you in a position to score us on that? How are we doing when it comes to surveillance?
Well, the entities that are working on that would be the CDC and the WHO.
And those would be your personal confidence in that organization?
I mean, I think it's fair. I'm not going to come up with a number scale for it because a lot of it is, again, with the current administration and budgeting and concerns and cuts, it's hard to know exactly what the state of those programs are right now, for instance, for the CDC. I think we do a fair job, but I think that absolutely could be better because the number two thing is that as soon as you realize that there is a threat, then there has to be a pot of gold coins, a pool of money
for a response
that you can have an immediate response. And one of the biggest challenges that goes along with this, I think, and we saw this with Zika, we saw this with Ebola, we saw this with SARS, we saw this with influenza, we see this with influenza every year. The nature of how things are reported in the media and who do you trust, the whole concept of fake news, especially as it intersects with just completely lack of reality with reporting on science sometimes.
And along those lines, it occurs to me that Bill Gates is a man who gets a lot of attention, and he's a brilliant guy. He and his wife have sounded these warnings about a possible pandemic and our lack of preparedness, not just in the United States, but the world, right?
Right, absolutely.
But the more you say it, I mean, it does become the boy crying wolf. Maybe people don't listen as much if you say it too many times. That might sound counterintuitive because people are always listening to Bill Gates. The media's always looking to quote him. But if he says the same thing too many times, maybe the impact is lost.
And I would completely agree, especially when
maybe others need to say it.
And that's a key piece, is I think that everyone needs to say it from a medical standpoint who is of a certain level of expertise or is in a position to communicate that. Because if it's one person over and over, as you know, what's going to happen is that when something is not occurring, then it's just not going to be a meaningful priority for those with the power and the resources to be able to do anything.
Gates does an interesting thing in a TED talk that I was listening to. He brings out on stage a barrel left over from the days of civil defense and the Cold War, when there was a threat of nuclear annihilation, mutually assured destruction between the superpowers, U.S. and the Soviet Union.
When I was a kid, the disaster we worried about most was a nuclear war. That's why we had a barrel like this down in our basement, filled with cans of food and water. When the nuclear attack came, we were supposed to go downstairs, hunker down, and eat out of that barrel. If anything kills over 10 million people in the next few decades, it's most likely to be a highly infectious virus rather than a war. Not missiles, but microbes.
I remember that period of time when that was constantly in the culture, in the zeitgeist. It was something you thought about a lot. The threat of nuclear war just hung over the world, really, as a cloud. Now, people don't see this kind of thing on that kind of scale, I guess. I don't know. But it's certainly not something that's talked about every day, right?
Yeah, no, that's absolutely true. And it's hard, I think, for people to contextualize it. I mean, people look back to sort of Ebola as an example where some hospitals, like the ones that were expected to be the true destinations for where an Ebola patient might end up, they actually built, they put infrastructure money, not only just into like protective equipment and protocols and training people, but they actually built specific patient rooms that were designed to deal with an agent of that level of infectiousness. And since we didn't really get a flood, thank goodness, of Ebola patients, then it's natural for some people to question, why did we even do this? We put all these resources into this thing. You have to think about maintaining those, because you're talking about, you know, how do you maintain even the things that are cleaning the air in those rooms? How do you maintain those protocols? Something we've done and a lot of hospitals have done. So at Sinai, we used to have this Ebola task force, which is what we created. And I was one of the co-heads of it years ago when this came into place. And so it was very clear when, fortunately, this was not going to have a major impact in terms of the number of cases in the U.S., we decided, you know, we have to figure out a way to at least have that ability to be prepared. And so we
have a team.
Right. It's the Emerging Pathogens Group. And the idea is that we meet on a regular basis to just look at, all right, all this, who is being trained? If something were to happen tomorrow, who are the people, and anybody, even if you're an expert, you need to be retrained on some sort of cycle. So how do we make sure that we're identifying the right people, we're keeping them being trained, even if there's nothing going on and it's off our radar? How are we checking our supplies
That's
of things?
Good. That's and it, good. And do you know if are other hospitals doing that?
Yes, absolutely.
If they picked up after Ebola with that? That's why you have fire drills.
Right.
That's why you have checkoff lists. That's why you do these things. It's called preparation. One more question for you, John. The threat that Gates is describing, is it something that could naturally develop as you described, or are we more concerned about bioterrorism?
You may remember from a few years ago where there were people who were looking at avian influenza and they were doing things to it in a lab to try to figure out how easy what it would be to mutate it, to change it so that it would be more easily transmitted between people and among people. And the goal of that, of course, was not a nefarious thing. The goal of that was to try to see how real of a worry is this and how can we be prepared for it, essentially asking those questions. And so that type of research federally is classified as something called dual use research of concern, meaning that you're doing research for a benign scientific reason, but if somebody could separately use it as a threat. And so there was this whole thing where a few years ago, the government actually stepped in based on the concerns of a particular group of people. And that type of research for this specific question with influenza was actually shut down for a period of time because there was a group that was very concerned about the idea of, well, if you're doing this, what happens if you make the super virus and what happens if that escapes? And then journal articles are being published. What happens if you publish this journal article and someone figures out how to do it in their basement lab and unleashes this sort of thing? And especially with Zika, now a lot of people have heard in the news that there's this technology called CRISPR, which is gene editing technology. It's a technique you can go in and easily edit genes. And so in the context of Zika, one of the things people are talking about is using it to essentially target the mosquito populations that carry Zika and essentially edit their genes so that it would make those particular that particular species or those affected species of mosquitoes infertile and die off. So then you're getting rid of the Zika if you're getting rid
of the carrier,
of the vector.
I mean, this would be a defense against bioterrorism.
It could be, but the concern is that if somebody gets a hold of this CRISPR technology, could they then create or could they get samples of viruses and make worse other?
Where I thought you were going. When you were talking about killing off
the
mosquitoes.
I wandered into the woods.
Well, killing off the mosquitoes sounds like a good way to stop a virus from spreading.
It does. But the concern is that the idea is maybe you can do almost anything to this.
Yes.
And then pulling it back to this question, could you make something that's even worse? And so that, I think, is a fear that some people have. I don't know how realistic in terms of how big of a fear that should actually be. What are the chances of this
compared to
happening?
What Gates is first talking about, the diseases that
right.
we
something
actually
that
in this
will
country
natural,
have,
something that yeah. could naturally mutate in nature. But that is one part of the discussion is could we intentionally make something worse?
Well, I think it's something for everyone to keep an eye on. Like, there are a lot of worries in the world, mm-hmm. right? Some are bigger than others, and this is one I think deserves vigilance. It doesn't seem to be a conversation in Washington.
And you know that, notice that when Bill Gates was talking to a group, he was talking to the Massachusetts Medical Society. He's preaching to the choir, but he's hopefully preaching to the most respected or one of the most respected medical choirs in the U.S. Mm-hmm. And he's using data that has actually been validated from a scientific simulation. And he's making the case to the people. So he's not lobbying, it sounds like, the government himself directly. But again, it goes to, if more of us have a level of urgency, and by us, I mean physicians who are in positions to be able to influence things, then hopefully that influence will lead to all of us at all levels being more prepared for what comes next.
John, thank you very much.
Thank you, Dan.
Dr. John Smarr is on the staff of Sinai Hospital in Baltimore. He's a specialist in infectious diseases and joins us roughly once a month on Roughly Speaking. And that's our show for now. Your thoughts are always welcome by email, Twitter, and on Facebook. Please tell your friends about the podcast. And if you get a chance, review our show on iTunes or your Apple Podcast app or on Stitcher for Android users. We really appreciate it. For our producers, Steve Early and Quinn Kelly in the Baltimore Sun Newsroom, I'm Dan Rodericks. Thanks for listening to Roughly Speaking. Have a good weekend, and we'll see you again soon.
Roughly Speaking with Dan Rodericks is brought to you by the Ivy Bookshop, an independent bookstore at Falls Road and Lake Avenue in Baltimore. This month, the Ivy welcomes Michael Downs to celebrate the launch of his book, The Strange and True Tale of Horace Wells, Surgeon Dentist. Downs imagines the mysteries behind the true story of Horace Wells, who first used laughing gas as an anesthetic, reshaping medicine and humanity's relationship with pain. Thursday, May 10th at 7 p.m. at the Ivy Bookshop, 6080 Falls Road. For more information, call 410-377-2966 or go to www.theivybookshop.com. The Ivy Bookshop, your book is waiting.